May it please the court. Liddell Nathan's case presents the situation where we have someone who is sentenced to 300 years. And it is our position that a sentence of 300 years without eligibility for parole until he's in his 80s is not consistent with the direction of the cases in the U.S. Supreme Court that deal with this issue, those being Graham, Miller, Roper, and Montgomery.
So are you saying he would effectively be serving 70-some-odd years before he'd be eligible for parole?
He'll be in his 80s.
And he'll be in his 80s, but how many years will he have served? He was 16 when he was
16,
convicted, so
that
somewhere
would be,
close
so
to
he
70.
Would be, 60-plus years, 65 years.
Okay, more than Mr. Carr, who was 50 years.
Yes, it would be in somewhere over 60 years, exactly. That's exactly right. One of the other issues before the court right now is whether there is a meaningful opportunity to obtain release based upon demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. And I believe the sentence in this case does not reflect that. Before I get into the specific arguments, I do want to address a preservation issue that the state has raised. The state has argued this issue is not properly before the court based on what's in this court's footnote and in Mr. Nathan's prior case. This court did say that the issue wasn't raised and it wasn't in a point relied on, but this court then went on to say that the issue was premature because it had to wait until we had the resentencing that took place in this case. I believe, in light of this court's footnote, and in this court having determined as being premature, that the issue now is properly before this court. Otherwise, this court, and it took note that it would have been rendering an advisory opinion. There's no questions on the preservation. I'm going to move right into the substance of what took place here. In Graham, the court talked about having a meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. In Graham, the court looked at the factors that Roper identified for saying that the death penalty was inappropriate for juveniles, and those were five factors that identified juveniles having less culpability and being less deserving of the most severe punishments, when compared to adults, juveniles lack maturity and an undeveloped sense of responsibility. Juveniles are more vulnerable, or susceptible to negative influences, that their characters are not as well formed, and the difficulty in differentiating between juvenile offenders whose acts evidence unfortunate, transient, and immaturity, and one whose acts reflect irreparable corruption. The state has argued that Graham was limited to the situation of non-homicides and that Miller is limited to the situation where it only involves something that is statutorily defined as life without parole. And there's, I think, critical language in Miller that says the following. Those features of youth are evident in the same way and to the same degree when, as in both cases here, a botched robbery turns into a killing. So Graham's reasoning, and specifically talking about Graham, implicates any life without him. It says any life without parole sentence imposed on a juvenile, even as its categorical bar relates only to non-homicide offenses. That language from Miller says to me the court was not limiting Graham to non-homicides, and that the court was, in Miller, taking up any life without parole, whether that be statutorily defined or a sentence that is an aggregate of sentences like Mr. Nathan has here.
Well, that's a big jump, though, between saying, you know, we're going to look at an individual sentence and its constitutionality, and taking several otherwise constitutional sentences and putting them together to have an unconstitutional effect. What in any of those three cases would suggest that they would buy the latter argument even though they bought the former?
In Miller, he actually had multiple cases. He was placed on probation and then got revoked because of his subsequent case. So there were multiple offenses going on that he was sentenced on. So I think that supports the position.
But the single sentence that they found to be unconstitutional was the mandatory life without an opportunity for the sentencer to consider the factors you've discussed.
I think we have to go back into the consistency of direction of where the court has been going. The fact that it went so far as in Montgomery to find it retroactive.
What about the fact that it's denied cert in every case similar to that you're suggesting here?
I'm sorry.
What about the fact that in the last term it's denied cert on all the cases similar to this? What's that say about their direction?
The denial of cert, I think, only says that the court is not ready to hear the issue. Maybe procedurally or the posture of the case is not appropriate for the court to take it. I don't think we can draw an inference that the court has taken is taking a position, because that's all we know is the court didn't see that particular case, whichever case it was, as being an appropriate vehicle to decide the issue. I think that's all we can draw.
How many states have taken up the issue and reached the conclusion that you're urging for us?
There's a split of authority, Your Honor, and I've acknowledged that in my brief. There are some, you know, decisions as well as legislatures that have taken this up, and I think they've looked for guidance both to Montgomery and the other cases that preceded Montgomery, and also there is a real split. There's some jurisdictions that, you know, view the 25 years of Montgomery, as this court invoked in its orders in these 80 cases, as a guiding principle and one that should be looked to.
How many have taken multiple constitutional sentences and found their combined effect is unconstitutional?
I don't know the numbers, Your Honor.
Is there only one case, or are there a dozen cases?
I think there's a significant split on both sides. Now, the numbers, I don't know. I do think the legislative direction that this is going is much more consistent with 25 to 30 than it is something outside of that in terms of...
Well, how do they address whether or not we look at Graham and Miller principles and how we apply them to this kind of situation where...
I think we have to look at the opportunity for a meaningful opportunity to obtain release, and that it be demonstrated based upon maturity and rehabilitation. And that really is a forward-looking process. I mean, that's what we're talking about in terms of the number of years that a person serves to demonstrate a certain maturity and rehabilitation to be eligible.
Of course, the legislature has, a lot broader authority over looking over these issues. For example, they can go beyond issues of culpability to the point of saying, do we want prisons filled with octogenarians? I mean, how we, the cost of taking care of octogenarians is something that would come in play with the legislature, which would not come into play with us.
Well, I think Missouri legislature has given us some hint about where it sees life without parole going, and that's what SB 590 did, and it was consistent with what this court did in its order, and the legislature looked to what I think this court did and what the U.S. Supreme Court was saying in terms of that 25-year mark.
Is it your position that because all of these sentences grew out of the same incident, whether the state charged them in a single count or whether the state broke it up into multiple counts, the same principles would apply? You look at the juvenile's actions and see whether, and you have to judge them in light of the mitigating factors that were identified in Graham and in Miller?
I think what you look at in terms of when we're talking parole eligibility, it has to be, again, future forward looking in the sense of that they've served a certain amount of time where they've had this opportunity to show maturity and rehabilitation. And that's why I go back to the 25-year mark. That seems to be at least a point that's been acceptable.
But you're jumping to the second mm-hmm. issue, and the second issue, you're making the assumption that the meaningful opportunity to obtain release is applicable.
Right, and...
In a multiple offense circumstance.
In terms of the meaningful opportunity, I think you look at the number of years that's been imposed and when the person would become eligible.
I think the question is more basic than that. Why the questions being asked, the state's position would be that Miller and Graham simply don't address the issue where you have multiple sentences. They just look at each sentence independently and decide and whether life without parole is appropriate or not. But here, if each sentence independently would be okay, then why is it incumbent on the court to decide whether it's constitutional to oppose them consecutively? Why do we look at the overall cumulative effect of imposing them consecutively if they're each independently constitutional? Is there something in Miller and Graham that says where you have a juvenile, you have to look at the overall effect and you have to consider the reasonable possibility of parole and having life outside regardless of the number of cases that they're convicted of?
There's nothing that that is mandated by Graham and Miller, but I think you have to look at those five factors that are identified in Graham as to why we treat juveniles differently. And I think those are the driving force as to why, in a situation like this, where you have 300 years, those all have to be weighed in and be part of the calculus of what is going to transpire with any particular individual. There's nothing that mandates the result under Graham and Miller, but I think we have to look at, as this court said in State X-Rail Simmons, we have to look at the consistency of the direction. And I think the consistency of the direction is to look at juveniles and the specific qualities that are characteristic of someone who is a juvenile.
How long is your client been incarcerated?
He's been in about 7 years right now.
Okay. And so if you assume for sake of argument that the 25-year minimum that's in the new Miller-Fick statute is unconstitutional, I mean, it would be several years. I guess what's the harm as it relates to your client to get clear direction from the United States Supreme Court as to whether a multiple case, multiple sentence situation such as we have here is actually violative of the Eighth Amendment?
I mean, I think,
because we're talking about eligibility, not release, why isn't it more prudent for all of us to wait for clear direction?
I think in terms of the harm to him personally, I mean, I think it goes to his, I think in some ways, the motivation, as the cases have talked about, to be a model prisoner, to show that you're capable of warranting being eligible for parole, that it gives a greater incentive, certainly to that person, to show the world that, hey, I really should be paroled when I become parole eligible. So it takes away some incentives there positively for him. But I also think this court needs to provide guidance, not only for Dale Nathan's case, but in other cases that are going to come along just like it. His is not going to be the only case.
Thank you.
I see my time is up.
May it please the court. At the outset, the state's position on the preservation of the challenge to the sentences, the state's position is that the original sentences that were part of the first direct appeal, we'll call it Nathan 1, none of those individual sentences were challenged except for the life without parole on the murder count. So when this case was remanded for the punishment phase proceeding on the murder count, it was also remanded for, I think, four other offenses involving victim Whitrock that the circuit court believed it didn't have jurisdiction over because of a juvenile certification question, which this court answered and said that the court had jurisdiction over those. So the only sentences at issue in this case, individual sentences, are the Whitrock offenses and the sentence of life with parole on the murder. The state's not taking the position that the court doesn't have authority over the combined effect of those sentences for an Eighth Amendment inquiry. So just to make that clear.
And he's not contesting the individual sentences. It's the combined effect that he's contesting.
Correct, Your Honor. That's the next thing I was getting ready to say. He's not challenging any of those other individual sentences, but just to make clear that those are his challenge to those where there was an opportunity and it's gone by now.
And why don't the principles, or why do the principles in Montgomery and Graham apply when to the cumulative effect of those sentences?
Well, Your Honor, when appellate courts issue decisions, there are holdings, and then there are a lot of stuff that surrounds the holdings, explaining the holdings. The holding in Miller was there can be no statutorily mandated sentence of life without parole. Miller came down during Mr. Nathan's first direct appeal. This court, without the guidance of Montgomery, of course, fashioned the remedy that it saw fit to remedy that Miller violation. The case was remanded. Mr. Nathan had a full evidentiary hearing, punishment phase proceeding, where he got to present his mitigating evidence.
And the jury found that they did not impose life without parole. They were unable to reach agreement on life without parole, so he was convicted of second-degree murder. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. They were unable to unanimously agree per this court's rubric in Nathan and Hart. That required a jury.
And as the U.S. Supreme Court has recently held in the Florida case, the jury has to agree on punishment. The state, the judge can't do it for them. But I mean, is it ironic here that if the jury had imposed, that the jury here found a lesser culpability, just exactly what Miller and Graham said they have to be given an opportunity to do, and yet he would not be eligible for parole in 25 years, whereas everybody else who had their sentence commuted to 25 years, who in fact was convicted of first-degree murder?
Well, first, Miller and Graham, nor Montgomery, require a jury to make this finding. It's the sentencer. In fact, I think Montgomery specifically says a judge, a sentencing judge, needs to take this into account. The jury requirement was just a function of Nathan and Hart in this court trying to grapple with what do we do.
But again, it's the cumulative effect denies him the eligibility for parole that first-degree murder, those convicted of first-degree murder would have. Is that right? I mean, here, the cumulative effect is he will not be eligible for parole until after he's statistically likely to be deceased.
Yeah, there's no record on the exact date. What I would not dispute is going to be in his 80s when he will be first eligible for parole. But under Miller, he got all the constitutional rights, I guess you could say, under Miller. He got the hearing that Miller said that he should have had before being sentenced to life without parole. So whether you look at it, Mr. Nathan does have.
But the thing is, he won that hearing in the sense that the jury found in his favor on that.
I don't know, Your Honor, because at the same time, the jury recommended maximum sentences on all the Whitrock offenses. So,
and he's contesting their consecutive nature, though, as opposed to the sentences.
And that's true. And that was not the jury's function. It's not
right,
under
absolutely.
Missouri law.
But why? Can you address the application of the principle set out in Miller and Graham to imposing those consecutively where they're based on the same incident? Does that give the state incentive to just break something out into multiple crimes rather than charging it as one crime so they can? And if the state were to do that, would that in effect be an end run around the principles regarding juvenile culpability that those cases set out? And if not, can you address further why you think it's not?
Well, they're separate offenses. Miller and Graham dealt with a single non-homicide offense. Miller, a single homicide offense. We can only go with what the U.S. Supreme Court tells us
and
what
can
their holdings
are. And can
are.
You go with the principles and how they apply or don't apply to these multiple, not whether it's exactly governed by it, I understand your argument, but the principles they apply in deciding it's not okay in the single crime offense or double crime offense, it actually was. How would they apply here where there's multiple crimes?
Well, because there are multiple crimes, he can be sentenced for each of those offenses. While they were on the same day, within the same couple hour period, there were a lot of decisions Mr. Nathan was making that for each first two victims, Officer Lobedina and Mr. Conan, were outside the house when they were first assaulted and at least approached with guns and robbed outside the house. Then they're told, Mr. Nathan and his co-defendant are told there's only women and children inside. Well, then they make the decision to go on inside. The record in this case shows Mr. Nathan was the more aggressive robber. He's armed with a gun. He's pointing the gun in the forehead of a 77-year-old woman, cursing at her, telling her, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did he shoot?
As this court knows, in the first trial, Mr. Nathan took responsibility for the shooting. Then, after the remand, the party stipulated that all the shots were fired from Mr. Coleman's, his co-defendant's gun.
So that's a stipulation in this case?
That's correct, Your Honor. Mr. Nathan was armed with a gun that had a faulty clip, faulty mechanism that allowed it to only shoot one bullet at a time.
Does the judge have an obligation in deciding whether or not to impose consecutive sentences to consider the Miller factors?
Well, sure. And that's what
does the court indicate it did that here, or does it indicate that it thinks those are a bunch of hooey and not? Is this something that the court indicated it considered in deciding on these sentences?
There are some citations in Mr. Nathan's brief to transcript from the very first trial. Miller's decided after the first trial, this court remands, told the court to impose the Nathan and Hart procedures, and the court did it. And during sentencing, the court directly addresses Mr. Nathan and tells him, I've considered all your circumstances. The court listened to all the evidence from the multiple witnesses, including expert witnesses, and it considered, it said it was considering the factors that it's supposed to consider in imposing the consecutive sentences in this case.
So the negative comments were from the original trial transcript?
They were from to the extent that they're suggesting they were negative comments, or at least comments suggesting that disagreement with certain U.S. Supreme Court rulings, they were from the first trial when there was no discretion for the trial court other than to impose consecutive sentences on the non-homicide offenses. But since he had life without parole, automatically for the homicide offense, it didn't make any difference at that point.
Did the trial court have discretion to ignore the jury's inability to find that he was one of the truly depraved juveniles who deserved life without parole? Could it relook at that and say, I think you are depraved, and so I'm going to make these consecutive, or did it have to accept that finding by the jury in determining its sentence?
No, and under the Eighth Amendment, it didn't need to be a jury to make that finding. It was
have that here, and jury found that.
That's right, but it wasn't constitutionally required. It was required by this court's procedure set out in Hart and Nathan, but not by the Eighth Amendment. Like I said, Montgomery makes clear the sentencing judge takes these factors into account. The jury only could not unanimously agree on the first degree murder charge should it be life without parole. They did unanimously agree he should get maximum sentences on the other Whitrock offenses, which were just a small part of the other 20-some offenses that were adjudicated in the first appeal. And we know Graham doesn't apply here because we have a homicide along with a multiple violent non-homicide offenses. What I find odd about the argument, I think their argument now is, as best I can tell from the reply brief, is that the Eighth Amendment requires eligibility for parole after 25 years, no matter how many offenses, no matter how heinous they are. We know Graham and Miller and Montgomery do not go anywhere near requiring that. Montgomery was a fix. You either give these individuals that had statutorily mandated LWOP, give them a hearing, or you can do this. Because as this court realized and the U.S. Supreme Court realized, it would be impossible to have hearings on that number of cases, and they allowed the states a way to fix that. But what I find odd about the argument is that they're asking this court to interpret the Eighth Amendment to take power away from itself. There's a long common law tradition of judges decide whether sentences are concurrent or consecutive. They're saying take that power away from Article 5 judges and give it to parole boards. Because we know from Graham and Miller, there's just an opportunity for parole. And Graham expressly says that these juvenile offenders, they don't have to be released during their natural life. So I think we would keep, the states would argue to follow the holdings in Graham and Miller and not try to extrapolate from that when when there's not been a case yet at the U.S. Supreme Court where you had these multiple violent offenses. Well,
and they've had the opportunity to take those cases and thus far haven't, correct?
Right. And I would agree. I would not argue that when this court denies transfer or when the U.S. Supreme Court denies cert, that you could read anything too much into it, but they have the opportunity.
Yeah, well, the U.S. Supreme Court denied certain, I think, three cases that were like Simmons v. Roper, Roper v. Simmons, then the year before it took that case and decided it. So.
And that's why I say what I say. As far as what have other states done, there are a couple of states that have found multiple consecutive sentences that would exceed a person's lifetime or ability to get parole to violate the spirit of Graham and Miller. But a lot of the cases that they have cited in their brief were for there are some that are like this case that involve a homicide and a bunch of non-homicide offenses, like Caballero, Bear Cloud, Null out of Iowa, Riley, and Ronquillo, which is out of Washington. But what the court did in those cases is what this court has already done in this case. They said that those sentences were unconstitutional until that defendant, that juvenile offender, gets a hearing required by Miller.
But the thing is, here they had the hearing and the jury found he didn't qualify for the higher punishment, and yet you're saying the judge can reach the judge's own decision on that and decide to make them consecutive. Without applying those same factors that the jury found did not warrant life without parole. So what good is it to send it back for a hearing? What's the point of that?
This may sound like semantics, but the jury didn't find that he didn't qualify for it. They just could not unanimously agree. It could have been one person. It could have been 11
persons. Say they had unanimously said he didn't qualify. Would you be arguing differently here? Because
no.
It requires the jury to find it.
No, I wouldn't be arguing differently because the Eighth Amendment doesn't require the jury to make that finding, and the sentencing judge still has...
And did the jury assume that he would be sentenced to the whole thing, consecutive or concurrent? I mean, they're not instructed on concurrent or consecutive. They're not consecutive on a parole. So for all the jury know, they were giving him all this anyway, right?
Right. They gave him... On the second degree, they gave him the maximum.
And I wasn't suggesting the jury gets to pick sentencing or concurrent or consecutive, but the point being that the jury having not found he had showed the kind of depraved nature that meant he should be in without parole, don't these other states look at that you have to apply those same principles in deciding how long the person's going to be in jail through consecutive sentences, and where the jury has not found he deserves life without parole, isn't it inconsistent to then say, but he's depraved enough that we're going to keep him in for the rest of his natural life, basically?
The Eighth Amendment doesn't prohibit it. It does not. The jury here couldn't unanimously agree on life without parole. They recommended life. They recommended maximum sentences on the other offenses that they had control over. And the judge had an independent statutory constitutional duty to determine whether the sentence run concurrently or consecutively. And what the judge did in this case did not violate the Eighth Amendment. Unless the court has any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to address the questions that both Judge Smith and Judge Breckenridge raised as to the judge in particular, because the state is seriously in the state of the record. Judge Durka did detailed orders in both cases in which he expressed this essentially as contempt for the evolving standards of decency, and he made statements at both sentencing proceedings. It's not confined to the original proceeding where he made these statements. In particular, as to the statements at the resentencing, in the transcript at page 1080, Ms. Widrock is expressing her just overwhelming feelings about having this case come back and not wanting to have it come back again. And the judge comments, perhaps Justice Kennedy and Justice Kagan will read your remarks someday. In his written order, the judge said, indeed, this lack of an anchor in the text of the Constitution, he's referring to the evolving standards of decency, or any other objective source, is cast in sharp relief by the opinion of the notorious Judge Weinstein. I've never heard another judge because of how they view the Eighth Amendment, refer to another judge as being notorious because of the views they took. And that's at legal file 229 to 230. So we have the judge at the sentencing hearing, the resentencing hearing, and also in his written order making statements that express a real contempt for the evolving standards of decency. And he said in the original sentencing that he wanted to be sure that Mr. Nathan was permanently incapacitated. And that's in his trial statement at that sentencing. And he said in that statement he was wanting to send a message to future judges and governors that Mr. Nathan should be permanently incapacitated. He also used this malice supply.
In resentencing, though, did he refuse to consider Nathan's evidence, mitigating evidence, in deciding whether to run them concurrently or consecutively?
I think these statements, both at the original sentencing and at the resentencing, combined together reflect that he did not.
Well, in the resentencing, was there, other than his commentary on the Supreme Court, was there anything as substantive as the statement you just cited from the first hearing?
Sure. I mean, the statement that he refers to Judge Weinstein is notorious because his views on the Eighth Amendment, and that's in his written order on the resentencing, conveys that, you know, this evolving standards of decency is just not something he thinks has any constitutional basis. It's extraneous, and it's just flat out wrong. I mean, that's in his written order. It's not in, and you have to take that into account with his statements to Ms. Whitrock at the actual sentencing itself.
Should we send it back and order this judge to apply the same sort of analysis with respect to Mr. Nathan's mitigating evidence that we asked the jury to apply, and which they did apply?
I don't think this judge can, based upon all his written remarks and his oral statements at both sentencings, is going to adhere to, and that's one of our fundamental complaints about all the consecutive time here, is that he expresses such contempt for the evolving standards of decency that he could not do it.
It was a bad question. Suppose we got a different judge, and I mean a perfectly pristine judge, and that judge followed the analysis in Miller, applying it to the decision of consecutive or concurrent, and analyzed the mitigating evidence and determined that consecutive sentences were appropriate. Would you have a constitutional argument left?
If the record shows that judge took into account the evolving standards of decency and looked at the perspective of in terms of being forward-looking as to maturity and rehabilitation, which I don't think you can be, in terms of those factors, in terms of when you impose consecutive sentences and you make statements like, I want you to be incapacitated essentially forever. I mean, I think the record would have to reflect that was properly done. That could be a remedy here, and it's certainly one option.
That assumes, of course, we can find a perfectly pristine judge.
Or how we would choose between the many we have to pick from.
I'm not sure how a judge would be designated, but I think we would want a record that is very different from this record, in which the judge is throughout, in both proceedings, expressing contempt
but
for the idea.
You are conceding, under some set of circumstances, that consecutive sentences totaling 300 would be constitutional.
I don't think a judge can make that determination that they should be consecutive from the standpoint of you should never get out. I think a judge can impose that, but I think there also should be an accompanying order, or with that order, saying that at 25 years he should at least be eligible for parole consideration. I think a judge.
What's the point of consecutive if it doesn't mean that? In other words, if you say, but I mean that he should be eligible after 25 years, then consecutive doesn't make any difference.
I think it goes back to what Montgomery said about the 25-year mark, and that they ought to at least be eligible for consideration. I'm not saying
but it doesn't say everybody's eligible for consideration, does it?
Anytime I think a juvenile is sentenced to more than 25 years, I think that has to be specified.
I think they're referring to if a juvenile is found under Miller to be one of the depraved who can be sentenced to life without parole, then you don't have to offer them parole where there's a homicide offense. Isn't that right?
If they're found to be one of the depraved.
Right. And so that was the question on remand. If the judge looks at it and applies the Miller factors and decides this person does not pass muster, under those factors, then could the person impose consecutive sentences?
I think that would be, if that sort of deprivation were found, then that would be, it would
because
be
because you can have a legal life without parole sentence.
If there's a homicide.
I think that is accurate.
Although here it was second degree, not first degree, so whether that would apply here is a question.
I think it's not clear because of the second degree finding. That's exactly right.
Lots of it isn't clear.
I'm sorry, Jim.
I said there are a lot of the holdings that aren't quite clear as to what they're applying.
Do we have any other
questions? Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'd ask the court to reverse. Thank you very much.